We'll take a look at the wonderful wildlife that inhabit Wisconsin next here on the Ideas Net. Larry Mueller with my guest, Scott Craven, UW-Madison and UW-Extension wildlife ecologist. Always great to have him come by the first Wednesday of the month. And here it is, July 1st, and he's back. You have a question about some wildlife in your neighborhood? Maybe there's something that's some identification issue. Maybe there's something that you wonder how to move it somewhere else. Maybe it's an identification question. Whatever. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org. We'll be glad to take your question. Scott, welcome back.
Well, good morning, Larry and listeners. It's great to be back. And as I mentioned in the intervening time, it's also great to be here July 1st with one of those things out of my list of responsibilities now gone.
Yes.
I am no longer associate chair of the department as of midnight last night. Someone else has taken over that that responsibility. So I no longer have any administrative responsibilities. So.
And that's a...
Hey, strike up the band, crack a cold one, raise the flag, whatever. That's a good thing. But lots of wildlife to talk about.
Oh, boy, there sure are. As of late last week, and we're going to be talking about wolves next week with Tim Van Dielen and Adrian Weideman have a new book out on wolves. But wolves in Wisconsin headed back on the endangered species list.
Well, it looks like it. It appears that a lot of groups were upset about the delisting process and the way it was handled. And it appears that the challenges issued, the Fish and Wildlife Service has agreed with some of the contentions that were raised. And as a result, if the court approves, likely this week, and they may have already in the last day or two, for at least the 60-day comment period, and perhaps longer, wolves will be back on the endangered species list. So they're like the weather. It's cold. It's hot. It's whatever. And it's unfortunate because I think the Department of Natural Resources, the state biologists at this point, are perfectly capable of handling and managing the wolf situation in Wisconsin, and they really need the tools available to them with the wolves delisted. Their hands are essentially tied when the animals are listed as endangered, and realistically, with the pretty good bump in the population this year, there are, in some people's minds at least, plenty of wolves out there. The population estimate rose about 14% to somewhere around 650. There's a range there, but somewhere around there in 162 packs. And interestingly enough, 23 of those packs were in central Wisconsin, 139 in the northern part of the state. So not only are there more wolves than 10 years ago a lot of people thought we'd ever have, but they're also much more widely distributed than I think people thought they ever would be. So there's a new management plan due in 2010, next year, and they're going to likely be some significant shifts and changes and so forth. But for now, likely headed back to endangered status.
Marshall has a question for you. Bob, hi. Thank you for calling.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
I have a fox that lives in or around my barn, which is kind of neat in itself, but it drives my dog crazy, and so the dog barks and barks and barks. How do I convince this fox to find another place to live?
Is it a gray fox or a red fox?
It's a little red fox.
And did it seem to have a den there, or do you know that it has a den, or is it just kind of using it for temporary shelter?
Well, I can't really tell. I just see this little guy running around. We've got horses, and so we've got a water tank with goldfish in the water tank, and I think he's trying to go fishing for the goldfish. But as I say, he's kind of neat, but I think he should go someplace else.
Well, I understand that sentiment. They're not very well equipped as members of the dog family to do any fishing, so they may be enjoying watching the goldfish, but probably can't do a whole lot more. If there were, I guess the first thing to do is spend a moment or two really looking carefully around the foundation and any other outbuildings or any wood piles or if there's whatever's around that might provide some shelter or a den site. See if there's any sign that the fox has done any excavation and has such a spot that it's using, and then take some steps to eliminate that attractive nuisance, as we might call it. And that may mean doing a little excavating your own and screening off a den entrance under the building, or removing some pile of something that it's utilizing. And that may go a long way toward toward its relocation voluntarily. If it gets to the point that nothing like that is working, and there are no particularly good or universal repellents that are going to help. The only thing that mammals in general find, well, not the only thing they find offensive, but the only thing readily available to use, are naphthalene or moth flakes. If there was something that the fox seemed to be spending a lot of time around, a couple handfuls of moth flakes thrown around there might also discourage it. But eventually it might get to the point where capturing the animal and removing it a ways away might be necessary. And if you're going to do something like that, that's something you'd want to run past your local conservation officer just to get the thumbs up that can be done. And a good-sized, sturdy live trap, as you might use for a woodchuck or rabbit, but bigger, obviously. And you should be able to catch the animal and move it.
Good luck. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call, Bob. Ann in McFarland, your turn. Hi, Ann.
Hi. I am overrun. My yard is overrun with ground squirrels and groundhogs.
Wow, the double whammy.
Yeah, and we are using sulfur bombs to put down in their holes. Mm-hmm. To get rid of them. We do this during the summer, typically, but it occurred to me last night, is it possible during the winter when all the grass is down and I can see where all the holes are, is it possible to put sulfur bombs down in the holes and smoke them out at that time?
Probably not. I mean, you wouldn't smoke them out. If you actually discovered the entrance to a woodchuck burrow system, and they can be quite extensive in terms of the amount of the length of the tunnel underground. If you actually found one during the winter when the woodchuck was down there essentially hibernating, and you gassed or fumigated the burrow, likely the animal would be killed in the burrow, and that would be the end of that. Now, if that's your objective...
Well, I didn't want to say it, but that is my objective.
Well, that's fine. And yes, that could happen, but you don't know in the winter what the active burrows are and what they aren't, whether you're close to the animal or whether you're not. So if you don't mind experimenting with a supply of gas cartridges or the sulfur bombs you're using, you could certainly try that. Uh-huh. And... nothing ventured, nothing gained, I guess, in terms of success. But you're not going to have any measure of success until the following spring when you see what shows up.
Right.
The ground squirrels, on the other hand, have very shallow burrows, and they're not very difficult at all to flood out of their burrows with your garden hose. If you can find those little burrows, they're very shallow. Usually it doesn't take but a less than a 5-gallon bucket of water, and that will bring them to the surface. And at that point, you may deal with them as you see fit. But there's also a little live trap available that kind of shove it in the soil over the burrow entrance. And then as the animal is essentially exposed to the water, it just runs out and runs right into the trap, and you have it. You can even catch them in a slip noose of fishing line placed around the burrow, and then again flush them out with water and pull on the noose, and you have the little animal suspended in the fishing line, and again can move it. Or again, what you do with it is up to you a bit. And both of these animals on your own property are unprotected. So whereas some people are very anxious about safely relocating them, others are less such inclined. So you decide where you fall on the spectrum, and then you can go from there. There are also some bait formulations available for ground squirrel control that can be placed down the burrow, following the label instructions to make sure the bait is in the burrow so it's not exposed to birds and other non-target mammals. And they're also very vulnerable to a rat trap.
Mm. I have used the rat trap, yes.
So the tricky part with that, of course, is to, again, place that somehow so it's not being exposed to things you don't want to catch or potentially put at risk. But there are numerous ways to deal with the ground squirrels. The woodchucks are a little more problematic.
Yep.
Burrow fumigation is one, But if you've got a regular, if you see a place where those animals, while they're active, are regularly moving from a burrow to a garden or to the neighbor's yard or under a fence or something, then that's a perfect place to position a live trap, and you can move a lot of them that way as well.
Mm-hmm. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling.
Thank you.
On to Paul in Green Bay. Paul, hello to you.
Hi there.
What's on your mind? Yeah.
Well, I'm 43 years old. I grew up in central Wisconsin. First 18 years of my life, I spent a lot of time in the woods, and I never saw a possum in the woods or on the road. Just never saw one. I went in the military, and that's when I first saw a possum. Now, it seems lately they're everywhere. Mm-hmm. And I just want to know, have they migrated north? I always considered it a southern animal. Have they migrated north, and is it because of global warming, or was I just not seeing them?
No, you weren't seeing them because they weren't there, in all probability. And the possum, you're absolutely right. The possum, Virginia possum, as it's called, is a southern animal. And they've been extending their range northward over quite a long time, literally a century or more. I think the party line or evidence suggests that they reached the Illinois-Wisconsin border in about the 1920s, somewhere around there, and they've been moving further north throughout that period of about 100 years, to the extent that I think they've probably colonized virtually all of Wisconsin right now, but they're certainly more abundant southern part of the state, less so in the central part of the state, and just a few scattered records in the far north. They tend to be more or less abundant depending on the severity of winter weather. So I think that the last couple of winters where we've had pretty long extended periods of snow and cold have probably set them back a little bit, but they're certainly here to stay in Wisconsin, and they do kind of, at the northern fringe of their range, which we are, they kind of vacillate back and forth, north and south, and in numbers based on any given winter. But just like the nine-banded armadillo, which is truly a southern animal, which is also rapidly extending northward from Texas and the Gulf Coast, I don't think they'll ever get to Wisconsin unless global warming really is even more of a problem than we think it's going to be. But at least for the time being, they're doing now what the possum did 100 years ago.
All right.
Gotcha.
Thanks for calling, Paul. Robbie in Apple River, Illinois. On to you. Hi, Robbie.
Good morning, gentlemen. My question is concerning our recent bear sightings we've had down in this part of the state. And then I heard Iowa Public Radio this morning speaking that the bear that had been sighted in Iowa and northern Illinois has made his way back to Baraboo.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just kind of wondering, was that a foray looking for a mate or looking for food or extending their territory?
Well, possibly some of all of the above,
yeah.
That particular animal, we actually had a seminar in the department yesterday, saw a nice graphic that DNR wildlife manager just west of Madison here had presented showing the sightings of this bear from northern Illinois right up kind of west of Madison and now back up into Columbia County. So the sightings, they're pretty conspicuous in open farm country.
Yeah.
So the sightings began to pile up, and it was clear that it was that one animal moving like that. But I think that the occurrence of bears in southern Wisconsin, in northern Illinois, in Iowa, and other parts generally south of what we consider normal bear range will only increase in the short term, simply because there are a lot of bears right now. And recent research, as we've talked about a couple times before, has documented just within the last year or so that there are probably twice and maybe even more than that, as many bears as were previously thought to be present in Wisconsin, particularly in the northern third or half of the state. And it's only logical then, with bears extending their range south under population pressure in terms of more bears, that that young ones in particular, young males in particular, will forage out or foray out into areas where they haven't been seen previously. So look for more than the occasional bear in the Apple River area, Robbie.
Okay. Thanks a lot for calling.
It was quite something to walk out my barn, and there he was just walking across the field. It was a different look. For sure.
Yeah.
Well, there have been lots of accounts just in the past few weeks of bears turning up in schoolyards and walking across farm fields and just being in places further south than where we expect them, and in habitats other than where we expect them. But that's a function of lots of bears, and just by laws of probability, they're going to turn up in places where people didn't expect them. They also turn up with great regularity now on trail cameras, which have become almost ubiquitous on the landscape. So you don't even need to be present to see the bear anymore. You just have to set up your trail camera in a likely spot, and all of a sudden, boom, there's a picture of a bear.
Thanks again for calling. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking Wildlife with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, Larry Mueller here. Paul in La Crosse has a question or a comment. Hi, Paul.
Good morning.
Morning.
It's a continuation of your last caller. This last weekend, a bear was killed in La Crosse. And it had wandered into a city park. It was getting late. They, you know, it had been followed literally across yards by people in their cars. And it was up in a tree, but they were worried that, you know, it might come down and do damage or hurt somebody, and so they killed it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really provoked a lot of outrage in the city. They felt that they should have tried to capture the animal, and they found out that the nearest dart gun was in Eau Claire.
Mm-hmm.
With all these sightings and things, as the bear's range increases and things like this, how well prepared is the DNR to remove these animals safely? Or can we expect that in the future that people just go out there and start killing these bears because they're a threat or a perceived threat?
Well, that's a very interesting question. We heard about that animal, too, and the way you conveyed it was the way we heard it, that the bear was up in a tree and literally in a city park. There were people all over the place, you know, playing soccer or picnicking, and here's a bear in a tree, which as long as the bear's in a tree is more of a curiosity than a problem, but the bear comes out of the tree and all of a sudden is frightened, cornered, kids approach it or whatever. I think the police made a call that in those circumstances and an inability to clear the area and the potential risk to safety that I think this is a balance between, let's see, what's the reaction if this bear is killed under the threat that it could be a problem versus the outcry or concern if the bear comes down a tree and
maul somebody.
So these are difficult situations in the bigger scheme of things with the numbers of bears we now see in the state, the greatly expanded number of harvest permits and hunting opportunity, the numbers of bears taken and so forth. An individual bear like that in a park is, of course, of concern to the people present or in the area. But in the bigger scheme of the health of the bear population or the numbers of bears we have, then that individual bear takes on a little different perspective. So that just a matter of something to think about when those kinds of circumstances come up. In terms of how engaged or prepared or ready people are to deal with bears in settings like that, that's a little more problematic. And, of course, there's a lag time between the bears seem to be moving around. We're having an increased frequency of contacts in the southern part of the state. You know, it's time for every office to have a culvert trap on hand. It's time for every office to have a capture gun and the necessary drugs on hand to immobilize the animals. That there is some lag time involved. And, I'm not sure what the current level of planning is, but there's not only lag time, but there's also cost. And as everybody well knows, the state budget right now is not all that great. So this is a case where if there are local conservation groups or animal welfare groups or something that want to see something productive done with their funds, you know, it strikes me here just kind of talking about this, Larry, that much the same way as groups maybe purchase the jaws of life for a local police department as a community service, here's a chance to perhaps purchase or supply some capture equipment or immobilization equipment or the culvert traps that are widely used in the northern part of the state but probably not present down here to make those a little more readily available.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see what happens.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Amy in Scandinavia, we'll turn to you now. Hi, Amy.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
I've got a quick question for you. Um, a couple of weeks ago, I was out in my garden and working away. It was the middle of the day, and I have a big hound dog that was kind of roaming the fields. And I know we have a coyote population around us. You hear them at night, but all of a sudden I heard this horrible, horrible screaming. It was just blood-curdling, and I thought, uh-oh, I wonder if my dogs hit a trap or what. So I left the garden and started walking across the fields and spotted a coyote standing in the middle of the field just screaming, not a yip, not a bark, but a scream at my dog, who was just standing there wagging his tail like, oh, this is fun.
Mm-hmm.
What was going on?
Well, good question. I mean, the encounters and the frequency of encounters and the degree of encounters of dogs and coyotes has, of course, ratcheted up quite a bit here in recent years in the southern part of the state, and is causing a fair bit of anxiety and some outcry for management response in urban and suburban areas, even the west side of Madison, as particularly small dogs have been taken by coyotes or mauled. You know, coyotes and dogs are closely related, as are fox and wolves. They're all members of the canid group or dog family, and they all interact with each other in various ways. And generally, they can be at the point where if the time of year is right and mates are not readily available, the response is crossbreeding. So we have wolf-dog hybrids and other such problems. But more often than not, it's an aggressive response, and wolves will kill coyotes, coyotes will kill fox, and so on. And small dogs are clearly taken by coyotes. So what that particular coyote's intentions were, they're known only to the coyote. The actual screaming, and coyotes have a wide repertoire of vocalizations. Perception of screaming as opposed to, you know, high-pitched barking or howling and so forth. I don't know exactly, Amy, what you heard, and I don't know what the coyote's intentions were, but the issue here is that the coyote and the dog were sizing each other up, and what actually happened? What was the end result of this?
Well, it was kind of wild. My dog is big. He's about 120 pounds. He's just a really big non-aggressive dog, and my guess was he wandered over there and maybe found a den or something, because we had seen in January, we'd seen a couple of coyotes yipping and chasing each other and thought, okay, maybe this is mating season, maybe, you know, we'll have pups someplace. So I was wondering if perhaps that was it, because she didn't leave even when I came on the scene. I came and kind of called him off, and he was just standing there wagging, you know, like, wow, isn't this fun?
Well, and that's certainly possible. The pups are certainly out of the den at this point, but they may have been nearby, and that may have been the response of the female coyote in terms of, you know, just attempting to either divert attention from the pups or warn the dog that any further approach was not going to be well received. But as long as the encounter ended successfully, or at least harmlessly from your perspective, the reality is that there are lots of coyotes out there, and there are lots of people living in the countryside with dogs, and these kinds of encounters are going to continue.
Sure will. Thanks for calling. Appreciate your call. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest. We have some more callers online, but you can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org. And Bill in Orfordville has a question for you. Bill.
Good morning. I've got the cure for all the rodents in everybody's backyard. We keep a team of Samoys, a sled team of Samoys, you know, and we got about a two-acre fenced yard here. And these fellas come from Siberia, and they will tunnel down to get the prey under the ground up to 3-4 feet. So the backyard, we call it squirrel land back there, looks like trench warfare, you know. And I have to hire a backhoe, I think, this fall to kind of put it in. But Fritz and Gracie and Gretel and the gang out there, they've completely wiped out the ground population of vermin.
Well, I guess other than the collateral damage you've sustained, that's probably a good thing. But that strikes me as being somewhat analogous to the normal response when people encounter a bat in the home, and the response is to grab a tennis racket and run willy-nilly through the house, swinging at breaking lamps and vases and things like that. And maybe they get the bat and maybe they don't. But I've noticed the same thing with our two Labradors. If we're away for a weekend and take the dogs, come back and look at my garden. Oh, the deer have chewed the peas down and the rabbits have gotten the lettuce and so forth. But when the dogs are around, they seem to manage to keep things at bay. So, yes, dogs can be a helpful tool in the arsenal of wildlife damage management.
Thanks, Bill, for calling. Appreciate it. Scott, we had an email, and I forget who the email is from.
The email was from Carol.
Carol.
It was from Carol in Caledonia, Minnesota. And if Carol is still listening, we might ask Carol for a bit more information on this bird, because without some scale there and in a black and white kind of fuzzy photograph, I'm not getting much, except it appears to be the shape and size of a finch, or maybe as big as a robin, and it's kind of light in that maybe it's a partial albino. But do we know if...
She'll send us another
email. Maybe we'll get a follow-up email, but if there's further information about size, circumstance, or color, we'll do our best to identify this bird.
Okay, and another email. Keith in Wanakee said, seems there are more cowbirds around every year. I live in northern Dane County. Is that your impression, too, and that of others who know around Wisconsin? Since they parasitize other birds, can we remove them? And then what happens to all the cowbirds trapped in the Kirkland warbler's nesting area?
Well, cowbirds are a nest parasite, so they do lay their eggs in the nests of other birds, and the young cowbirds hatch quickly and dispose of the young that should have been in there. So people find that psychologically, it's a good strategy for the cowbirds. It works very well, but it is problematic for songbird management, and especially difficult for an endangered bird like the Kirtland's warbler. So cowbird control is practiced in the limited range of Kirtland warblers, and those birds are removed and, I assume, destroyed. As a member of the blackbird group, cowbirds too are protected, except by the provisions and the regulations that allow blackbirds to be controlled on someone's property if they're concentrated so as to constitute a nuisance or about to do damage. So again, if the perception of property owners that cowbirds are causing damage through nest parasitism or whatever other reason, they could be controlled. But the basic issue, are there more cowbirds this year? Not something I've seen around our property, nor have I had any calls or such things mentioning that.
No, I haven't
so
either.
This is another case where we can turn to the many very good birders and scattered around the state who are listening. If there's any sense that the cowbird situation is on the increase or perhaps more egregious than normal, give us a call.
And speaking of calls, let's go to Stephanie in Beloit. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi there, you all. I have a question about foxes.
Okay.
We lost some little half-grown chicks to what we think is a fox, and apparently it was able to burrow under this very heavy metal cage and get inside because there was nothing left but feathers.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to know a little bit about their lifestyle, how they range, where do they put their food. I was thinking if I could go find where he hid the chicks, maybe I could accuse him.
Well, how many chicks are we talking about?
Oh, there were only four. These were half-grown, mm-hmm. in the comb. And I couldn't believe that a fox would dig under the way this seemed to be dug under. The other idea I had was maybe a raccoon dug the hole and took a couple, and then the others got out, and the fox got them. But
well,
I've never seen foxes before this year, and I have seen a fox twice now in my yard.
There have been a fair number of fox calls and people interested in foxes over the last month or two. Whether that's a reflection of population change or not, I don't know. The fox population kind of gets pushed around and squeezed a bit by the coyote population. But can you describe the hole that was made? Was it big enough to admit a fox?
Oh, I didn't think so. 8 inches deep, Dave, is that what you say? Yeah, he shook his head.
8 inches in diameter?
A little wider than 6.
That's probably enough. That's probably enough to let them in, and certainly they and so the cage was big enough for a fox to get in there and move around once it tunneled underneath. Okay.
Yeah, right.
Well, that's certainly a possibility. There are others as well. Some members of the weasel family, of course, are notorious chicken thieves. A raccoon would be less likely to dig its way in. Skunk. Another possibility. Had the hole been smaller, I'd have even suggested a rat, which are very efficient, surprising
now,
predators.
Are they protected?
The foxes?
Yeah.
On your own property, there are, again, exclusions or clauses in the Wisconsin game regulations. They're a fur bearer and a game animal, but they're one of those animals that on your own property, you may hunt or control them throughout the year. If you're going to get involved in that in a big way, I would just be tempted to, in fact, I'd recommend that you run it past your local conservation officer just to verify their perception of what you can and can't do, and just so that they know what you are doing in case neighbors get, different people have different, very different yeah. attitudes toward wildlife, and just to protect yourself and to know exactly what you can and can't do within the law, I would always run that past the local conservation officer.
All right.
And chances are you'll just get the thumbs up. But if you've got more chicks and you're concerned this is going to happen again,
yeah.
then I'd
go. We are concerned.
Well, then I think that until you know what it is, and the best way to figure that out is the hole in and of itself isn't very diagnostic. But where there's loose dirt, there are tracks. And where you go under a fence or any sharp metal, there's usually a few hairs grabbed.
Mm.
And if you can find a couple of hairs or a track, then you'd have more information to go on than you do now. But the notion that you could go out and find where the fox might have consumed the chickens or cached them for later use or fed them to pups probably isn't going to happen.
No.
So I think you need to collect some more information and be prepared with a good stout live trap if the problem recurs.
And thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Ken in Algoma, we're on to you now. Hi, Ken.
Hi. This spring when the fields are worked and planted, as you drive around, you see large flocks of cranes. Mm-hmm. There. What are they eating?
Well, cranes eat a varied diet. They'll eat frogs, snakes, mice, certainly grain where it's available. Earthworms, I mean, much like you see big flocks of gulls and so forth following tractors that are working fields in the spring, because the tractor's turning over earthworms, grubs, and other things in the field, cranes proceed in the same way, but they're also looking for waste grain and anything else they can turn up. They're surprisingly diverse in their diet.
Okay, thank you.
Yep. All right, thanks for calling. Sandy in Ferryville, your turn. Hi, Sandy.
Hi. Morning.
Morning.
I wanted to find out if rattlesnakes are on the protected list and what you would do about an encounter with one on your property.
Well, there. You know, we only have the two different species of rattlesnakes in the state. Mm-hmm. The Massasauga, or swamp rattlesnake as it's called, is very restricted to some low, damp, or swampy areas in the west-central part of the state and perhaps a few remnant populations elsewhere in the southern part of the state. It's very unlikely you'd come in contact with a Massasauga, but if you did, those are an endangered species. So there's the highest level of protection there. The timber rattlesnake, which is by far the more common, but still restricted to certainly the southwestern quarter of the state, but particularly along the lower Wisconsin and Mississippi rivers and the bluffs and rocks and whatnot. There was a great deal of interest in providing substantial protection for the timber rattlesnake back 6 or 7 years ago, but it never really got full protection. But I'm trying to think of the designation now. Species of special. It does have protection, but not at the level of an endangered or threatened species. And I think on your own property, I think you're free to deal with them as you may feel necessary. If
okay.
If one is encountered, again, depending on your level of, I don't want to say expertise with snakes, but comfort level with snakes, I mean, they can certainly be, you know, moved across the property. I certainly don't recommend and indiscriminate killing just for the sake, ooh, there's one, we better kill it.
Yeah.
I know people within the range who have... one fellow in particular who has a regular aggregation of timber rattlesnakes under an old stump on a cut bank on the road right in front of the house. And, you know, you can go there just about any time and see a couple of snakes sunning themselves. And they know they're there. The snakes know they're there. And, you know, they've reached a level of peaceful coexistence that no one seems too concerned about it. So it really depends a little bit on your own mindset or temperament when it comes to the tolerance levels for those snakes.
Right.
If it were me, and of course, you know, you've got grandchildren running around or something, and, you know, there's a timber rattlesnake frequenting the deck or under the deck or whatever, then I would get some help and have that thing removed.
Yeah. Right. Okay.
All right. Thanks for calling. Appreciate your call. And John in Wrightstown. On to you now. Hi, John.
Hi. How are you doing?
Good.
Enjoying your show.
Thank you.
Last night I was going across number two across the northern part of the state, and just after I got into upper Michigan, maybe 30, 40 miles or so, I had a cougar cross in front of me. It was a large, definite cougar. My question is have there always been cougars up there, or are they ones that have been domesticated and let loose, or what's up with them?
All right.
Well, John, you've opened a real can of cougars here for us to deal with. The cougar situation has a long and convoluted history, and some contentious aspects in Michigan, where there have been some DNA tests and analysis of scats and so forth that some groups say indicate the presence of X numbers of cougars, and other groups kind of debunk or don't necessarily have any faith in. The reality of the situation is that there have, for several years now, some documented cases of cougars in Wisconsin, and some documented cases of cougars moving in an easterly direction from the Dakotas and more what we'd consider the central part of their range. But lots and lots of sightings, some of which have been verified now, most last year with the case of the cougar in Rock County that was ultimately shot in Chicago, and just a couple of months ago with a cougar that was treed up in Burnett County, and where that animal went, I'm not sure anybody knows at this point, but they can cover hundreds of miles. So I don't have any doubts that you saw a cougar, but where it came from, where it's going, or whether it's a resident animal is up for considerable debate. And since you mentioned it, I'll just say that some of the sightings over the years, were the truth known, probably were traced to captive animals that had been released or escaped or what have you. But there are certainly cases recently where there are bona fide wild cougars in the region that have moved here from other parts of the country, and probably some that have set up residence. So a cougar management plan is being worked on. There's a cougar interest group, a group of students at Stevens Point who track cougar sightings. They're around. So
yeah,
you got to see one. Congratulations.
Yeah, good for you. I'd like to see one sometime. Thanks a lot for calling, John. Appreciate your call as well. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Wildlife on our minds today here on the Ideas Net with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, Larry Mueller here. And let's go to Jen in Barnum, Minnesota. Hello, thank you for calling.
Yeah, hi, thanks for taking my call. First I wanted to say we have seen more cowbirds in our area, too. I just wanted to mention that because that earlier caller had commented on
right.
that, too. And starlings, too. We had a huge flock of starlings that came in last fall, and they were actually eating in the bird feeder, which I didn't think starlings did, feeding on the black oil sunflower seeds, just hundreds of them. And they stayed a good portion of them stayed over the winter, and we've still got them around here this year. I haven't seen them. We've lived here for 7 years and hadn't seen them until last year. But anyway, what I was calling about was a coyote story. About 7 or 8 years ago, we lived in an area where we had a pair of coyotes that came every year frequently. One of them was a three-legged that had probably lost a leg in a trap, we assumed. And so they had a lot of pups every year, and we got really used to hearing all of the variety of sounds. And, you know, you just could tell right away whether it was a feeding or hunting sound and or play and whatnot. But one morning about 5 a.m. or so, I heard this just mournful cry from, I wasn't even certain that it was a coyote, but it was just awful. You could just tell the animal was in distress. And it was really bothered me so much, I just got up and threw my boots and jeans on, and I followed the sound into the woods about a quarter of a mile or so across the road from us. And I came up to, I found the coyote, and she was by what appeared to be her den. And then about maybe 50 or 60 feet away, my side of the den from her, right on the path that I was walking on, there was a dead pup. and the pup was probably looked like what a maybe 6 or 7 week old dog would look like.
Mm-hmm.
And no wounds, no blood, nothing on the pup. It looked just all intact, but just laying there. And so I just left it alone and went back home. And the next morning, the same thing happened. And the poor mother was crying again for about an hour. And I thought, well, I got to go back and see. And there was another pup. And this one was a little bit closer to the den. And then the same thing happened the third day, but I didn't go back to the woods. I just assumed it was the same thing. But what do you think? I was wondering about distemper or what do you think may have caused the...
Yeah.
Well, there's certainly no way to tell without a necropsy, but certainly without any visible markings on the animal and no obvious defense by the female against something, you know, attempting to get the pups or raid the den, it sounds as though some type of disease or parasite load or some other problem other than immediate trauma or predation was to blame. But what it might be, who knows? There are a number of things that can affect the animals. You mentioned a couple of them, but that would seem to me to be the most likely explanation. And the the mournful cry and the wailing or the screaming that that we had earlier on, I guess that was Amy who called in.
Yeah.
With the coyote screaming with the dog. They do have a variety of vocalizations, and I think where we tend to get a little more involved or engaged, I shouldn't say rather more than we should, but when you attach some anthropomorphic, you know, meanings and whatnot to the sounds you're hearing, and in some cases that may be entirely justified, but in some cases it may not be, and it tends to get us perhaps a little more emotionally involved. But certainly the animal was obviously distraught over what was going on, but what happened, who knows?
Thank you very much for calling. There were probably some very distressed ground squirrels. The fellow with the Samoyeds just emailed us a couple of pictures.
Whoa, that's some serious excavation.
Yeah, take a look at the second picture. The dog's tail is...
that's... Holy mackerel, those are good-sized dogs, and all you can see is the tail sticking up out of the ground.
Out of the hole in the lawn.
Well...
So there you have it.
There you have it.
Samoyeds. If you want to get rid of the ground squirrels, you're going to get rid of them with the Samoyeds. Don and Holman, it's on to you now. Hi, Don.
Good morning, or afternoon, or whatever. Two things. One is I wanted to compliment Scott on his work with the Wisconsin Coverts Project. I was fortunate enough to be in the group in 2008, and I wanted to report to you that I have had that voluminous three-ring binder in my home less than it's been out. It's been loaned to Rudy's Feed and Seed in Holman. It's been with the Wisconsin Waterfowl Association chapters, neighbors, and so on. But I have truly, truly benefited from partaking in the Coverts Project. The second thing, and it's hard to do, but the proper pronunciation, the Indian pronunciation, is coyote.
Mm-hmm.
That's
yeah.
It.
Yeah, it actually comes from the Spanish term coyotl. And there are several different, depending on where you are in the country, there are a variety of pronunciations of that name and a variety of other names for the animal that are even less complimentary, perhaps. So it's kind of the potato-potato thing in some areas. But thank you very much, Don, for the very nice comments on the Coverts Project. For
tell
the
people,
listeners
yeah.
unaware of it, this is an extension program we've been working on since 1993 that's designed... It's sponsored by the Rough Grouse Society and several other conservation groups, but primarily the Rough Grouse Society. And it's designed to... bring private woodland owners together for a pretty intensive 3-day workshop on good forest stewardship, including both forestry and wildlife management, with an emphasis on habitat protection and enhancement for grouse and woodcock in particular. But we talk about a wide range of species. And this year there are two Coverts workshops coming up in August, the second and the fourth week of August, up at the Kemp Natural Resources Station in Woodruff. It's a great place to have a workshop. And the participants, limited to 25 landowners, they come in on a Thursday night and depart at Sunday noon. And for those 2.5, 3 days, they're pretty much going for all daylight hours on various sessions and tours and demonstrations and so forth. Again, designed to empower them, much like Don described here, to go home. But what our hope is that they'll go home to their community and use the literature that we've provided them and some of the ideas and discussion topics that we've provided and spread the word of what good forest stewardship is all about to their friends, neighbors, and colleagues, and so forth. And
sounds
apparently,
like Don's done
apparently
a great
thing. Don is just perfect in that regard. So that's great. So,
and I tell you, it's I wonder if it's making a difference. The grouse populations are up again now, aren't they?
Well, they are, and that's also good news. Something we wanted to talk about: population levels were up in the north and central regions of the state again for about the fourth year in a row. The increase in central Wisconsin was about 14% and about 6% in the north. Southwest and southeast were down rather dramatically. But overall, the state population was up. As most people, I think, know, grouse fluctuate in their populations on roughly a 10-year cycle. And the peaks, which are what all hunters wait for, is this the big year for grouse, generally end in a 9, give or take a year or two. So the thinking is there could be another year of increase, primarily because Minnesota had a huge increase this year, almost an unbelievable increase of 44%.
Wow.
We didn't see anything like that, but it tends to work its way toward us across Minnesota. So we might see one more increase yet next year. But bottom line is, although it's not a huge increase, there will be more grouse up in the North Woods, and grouse hunters should look for another great season.
Let's take another call. Adam in Rockford will turn to you now. Hi, Adam. Thank you for calling.
Good morning, gentlemen. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I've heard a couple different times, a couple times today, and quite often people call in with problems regarding wildlife, causing damage or doing something to them or their property or their pets that seems like it's pretty avoidable.
Mm-hmm.
Today, the lady had called about her chicks and, you know, the fox or raccoon or whatever it was that was getting in and eating her chicks and wanted to know about killing the foxes. People want to kill the coyotes because they have interactions with their dogs. And I wondered if maybe you could speak a little bit on people's responsibilities with their own pets that, you know, if you're going to let your dog run loose without a leash or unattended, or, you know, people could build better cages for their chicks to be in, that things can't really get in, as opposed to taking the first response of, well, I'll just kill that animal or wipe these out or whatever, you know. It just seems to be a commonly occurring problem that people just want to kill the pests and forget that they have responsibility for their own animals.
Well, that's a terrific comment, Adam, and I think if you got a hold of, for example, any of our Extension, University of Wisconsin Extension publications on most of these animal problems, you'd see that our normal approach is to describe the problem and the underlying causes of the problem, and then go through the litany of control options, starting with the least invasive, things like repellents or scare tactics or building a better fence or a better pen, as you described, and ending only with the lethal control as the last resort. Often the callers to this program will call in with the disposition or mindset that, excuse me, that they've already moved past some of the initial stages, and at this point they want the animal removed. And in some cases, that's the way the system works. People will try banging pots and pans to chase a woodpecker off the siding, and then they'll try some repellent or they'll try a little netting. And after perhaps weeks or months of frustration, by the time they get to us, it's, no, we don't want to hear about all that stuff. We want that animal gone. When in reality, there are things that we do as people, as pet owners, as livestock managers, as gardeners or farmers, that obviously impact the habitat of these many animals that are out there, often usurp it, or we build a house in a woodlot and then wonder why the raccoons are in the chimney and the rabbits are under the deck and so forth. And usually, if you're listening sometime here late summer or fall, we often at that time take a little time to say, hey, folks, it's time to get out there and look around your house and take some steps to animal-proof the house so that you can avoid this problem, that problem, and another problem. And not impact, in other words, you and the animal can coexist, much as we were talking about with the rattlesnakes a minute ago. You and the animals can coexist. The reality is that although we do get a lot of callers who want something gone, the reality is that most people really enjoy having wildlife around. And that's been one of the great parts of my job for many years, is that most people are very much enthusiastic and supportive of wildlife populations. And it's only when their ox is being gored, so to speak, they've got a problem, they're frustrated by it, they don't know how to deal with it, that all of a sudden their tolerance for that particular animal has just about dried up. But you're absolutely right. Everybody does have some responsibility to take steps to protect their livestock, their home, their garden, which is why in the spring or if somebody comes to me and says, gee, I'm going to put in a vegetable garden, fence the darn thing. Yeah. I don't need a fence. Oh, yes, you will. And if you take preventative measures with wildlife damage, an ounce of prevention is truly worth a pound of cure. And if you build the fence, if you build the cage a little tighter, if you animal-proof your home, if you put an animal-proof chimney cap on the chimney, all of a sudden a lot of these problems just go away or never occur in the first place. So yeah. Thanks for that prompt, Adam.
And thanks for that comment. It's a great comment, Scott. Scott Craven, UW Extension wildlife ecologist, our guest here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at the wonderful world of Wisconsin wildlife with Scott Craven, UW Extension wildlife ecologist, Larry Mueller here. And Scott, Wisconsin Farm Technology Days are coming up July 21st, 22nd, and 23rd at the Crave Brothers Farm, that's a couple miles north of Waterloo in Dodge County, and people want to see you. You're going to be there.
We'll be there. Jamie and I will be working Farm Tech Days again for the 3 days, Jamie early in the session and me batting cleanup. So be setting up on Monday, and then the show's a Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday show. For folks who have not been to Farm Tech Days, if you've got any interest in agriculture at all, it's pretty impressive, actually. The equipment and the technology involved in farming these days is mind-boggling, and this is quite the exposition. So there's plenty to see for everybody and things to do and learn about and whatnot. And we will be in the Farm Progress Pavilion right in the center part of the Tent City area, and look for us at the Wildlife on the Farm exhibit. And our colleagues from USDA Wildlife Services will be right around the partition behind us handling all the animal damage stuff. So stop by and say hello.
Absolutely. It's the 21st, 22nd, and 23rd. And actually, you can go online if you just type in Wisconsin Farm Technology Days. It pops right up, and you get all the information you need. Doug in Green Bay has a question for you. So let's go to Doug. Hi, Doug.
Hello. I live in an area that's got about 15 acres of undeveloped woodland and a creek running through it, but it's bordered by a park, some businesses on one side, houses on another side, and the highway on the other side. But there's a lot of fox living in there, and people feed them. I thought I was the only one. I threw some bread out there a couple times. I thought, oh, that's not enough to survive. But then I've come back and I see people feed them mornings, people feed them at nights. These fox will come out like clockwork at those times. Now, maybe that's their natural time to come out at dusk and dawn. But is there harm in feeding them, and what should people feed them, or shouldn't they bother?
Well, it's not a case of not bothering. I think they kind of like the discussion we had before the break with Adam about people's response to animal problems. This is a case where, again, we tend to feel, as people, we tend to feel that these animals are somehow reliant on us, that they can't find enough to eat on their own. And in reality, they can, or they wouldn't be there. So that little patch of woods is, and I think you'd be surprised where those foxes probably are at night in terms of roaming around the neighborhoods and the backyards and so forth, feeding on the rabbits under your deck or whatever they can get a hold of. If the conditions, if the habitat requirements that they needed were not present, the foxes wouldn't be either. So they don't need our handouts. And generally, if we wanted to do something detrimental to the fox in terms of habituating them to people and losing their fear of people. That's when these animals start to get into trouble and be perceived as a problem. So the bottom line to your question, Doug, is that although it may bring the animals out at a set time and you know that makes it easier to interact with them or take pictures of them or whatever, feeding them is not necessary, and in the long run, it's probably ill-advised.
There you have it. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. Email from Jeanette, who says, Scott, I was a student of yours back in 1992 to 1997. I never missed a day of terrestrial vertebrates. You were and still are an excellent teacher. My question is about snakes and their climbing ability. My friend has an old silo on his property that extends several feet below ground. Daily, he finds snakes in the bottom of the silo, milk snakes and garter snakes. Are the snakes falling into the silo or coming in through the cracks? My friend jumps down into his silo and rescues the snakes on a regular basis. Does he need to continue this rescue mission, or can the snakes crawl up and out on their own?
Chances are the snakes could get up and out on their own, and it's not likely they're climbing high up on the silo and falling down in. It's mm-hmm. if there are cracks or fissures or something in the base, the substrate of the silo, those snakes are likely getting in some other way than coming down from above. And if they can get in, likely they can get out. And some of these, despite the fact that most people are mystified by how a snake moves in the first place with no arms, yeah, legs, or any other appendages, they're actually pretty capable when it comes to locomotion. And some of them, rat snakes and bull snakes and so forth, regularly and frequently climb trees and get around just fine in trees and bushes. If there's some concern here, if there's a level above which they seem to be coming in but then falling down in, rather than the daily rescue mission, I would simply, if the silo isn't being used for anything else, I'd build a little rough lumber ramp from the substrate up to whatever level they seem to have access on, and make it a little easier for the snakes to get out if they are trapped. Because sooner or later, he's going to be on vacation, yeah, and, gee, they're going to be trapped in there for a week or so. So I think they're probably fine, but some sort of a little exit ramp or enlarging one of the cracks or crevices might help a little bit.
Well, here is a great email that I have to, before we go to Deb in Chautauqua, from Scott in from Hayes Bicycle Group. This past weekend, my wife and I were coming home from the John Muir Trails located in Kettle Moraine. About 10 miles from our house, we were stopped at an intersection, and off to our right, there was a small flock of birds flying around a rather large hawk. As we waited for the traffic light to change, the birds headed straight toward our truck. When the hawk was about 20 feet from our hood, it started to pull up like it was going to land, but I thought surely it wouldn't just land on the roof of our vehicle. And that's when I remembered our mountain bikes were on top of the truck acting like a big perch. Have a look at the attached picture. It was taken through the moonroof with the window open, which only stayed that way for a brief period because as soon as it opened, the hawk was all eyes on us and was pretty intimidating. After he landed, he rode with us for about 6 miles at speeds of up to 50 miles an hour. He would tuck down and lean his head into the wind using his talons to cling to the stem and the handlebar. And as we drove, we had 4 or 5 cars fighting for position around us, taking pictures with cameras and phones.
This is a great picture.
It was quite a sight.
The bird's right on, I mean, for the listeners, the bird's right up there on the handlebars, leaning forward like it's been doing this for its entire life. Assuming this is a good quality digital photograph, which it probably is, I would be tempted to recommend to our photographer here that they send this to a magazine like Audubon or National Wildlife or something like that. I think they would probably like to publish it, as well as the anecdote that goes along with it. Birds, raptors like that are routinely harassed by small songbirds of various types, and the bird probably viewed this as an escape and a way to get away more quickly than it could fly. That's really neat.
I'll let you keep that if you want to keep
thanks.
That. Deb in Chautauqua, thanks for waiting. Hello.
Hi there. My question is about the difference between fishers and martens. I live in Chautauqua, so it's we're up north. I live outside of town, kind of between a lake and a former farm field, which is now turned into a tree farm.
Mm-hmm.
And so the other night, I think it was, like I said, about a week ago, probably at 9 o'clock at night, I was out looking for my dog, and here was this like really short-legged, long cat-like creature
mm-hmm.
running across my yard. And unfortunately, it was, you know, they move fast, and it was kind of too dark to be able to get a real good identification on it. But, you know, so I did some research online, and it looks like it's either a Fisher or a Martin.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, can you tell me any more about that, or you know, if one's more common than the other, or where I could go online to get better images to be able to
sure.
identify?
Well, the odds, just on the basis of odds or probability, Fisher, hands down. Far more common, far more widespread, far more visible than the Martin.
Okay.
Martins are rather rare, population probably numbering in the few hundreds.
They were
restored to northern Wisconsin and have been recently been, the population has been further augmented. In an attempt to get them to take off population-wise in the northern forest the way Fishers did. Fishers caught on and spread and multiplied very quickly. And
okay.
have become a very common sight. Martins did not, for a variety of reasons. But if you saw one of the animals, the Martin, generally lighter in color, a more golden color, more like a mink in size, if you know what a mink looks like, and lower to the ground, more tubular and cylindrical, whereas the Fisher, although short-legged, would be a higher, bigger animal, more approaching kind of a slender raccoon size, much darker in color, very visible, bigger, bushy tail, and kind of a loping, hopping gait. I'm not sure if that helps you at all, but
yeah,
going...
it does. Well, and I, you know, the thing is, and it was 9 o'clock at night, so getting a, like I said, getting color, you know, on it, you know, it's kind of difficult. But we stared each other down a little bit before he went off again, and then you know, looked at him again, and he seemed really dark. His fur was really dark.
Yeah, a Fisher would appear almost black under most
yeah.
circumstances. So,
and it seemed like it was, I don't know, like maybe you know, a good 2 feet, maybe a little bit longer. I don't know if that...
Well, I know. I think, again, just on the basis of odds, when we, you know, we deal with these things, I would, my guess would be Fisher.
Okay.
Given the setting and the circumstances and the size and the color. But if you go to Google Images and type in either animal, you'll probably get dozens of pictures of either one. And or a good field guide to the mammals, a book like Jackson's Mammals of Wisconsin or Charlie Long's new book on Wisconsin mammals or Stan Tequila's Mammal Field Guide for Wisconsin. Any of those books would have good pictures of them.
Okay. I might be heading to the library.
All okay. right. Thanks a lot for calling. And Dick in Waukesha, it's your turn. Hi, Dick.
Well, I had a question about Martin, too, but I think it's been answered. But maybe a little anecdote about the Fisher.
Mm-hmm.
Back in the late 50s, I was on the Watersmeet Ranger District of the Ottawa National Forest when we were a part of the release effort of the Fisher.
Mm-hmm.
They were live trapped in Minnesota and came down in pickup truck loads, nice pine boxes with a quarter-inch mesh on one end. Our instructions were to weigh the animals, determine the gender, and put an ear clip. And this was in, I can't remember, in the spring, I think.
Mm-hmm.
We had a Michigan biologist, a wildlife biologist with us, DNR biologist, and three Forest Service people. Well, we figured out how to get the animals out of the box. We cut a round hole the size of a stovepipe, and we used a hose bag, took the hose out, and we weighed ourselves with the empty bag, and then when we stuck that hose, that pipe into the box, the Fisher ran into it, and we into the bag, and we closed the bag and weighed ourselves again.
Mm-hmm.
That was easy.
Yeah.
But then, where do you grab?
Yeah.
It was bouncing around in there. And we all got bitten over a period of 3 or 4 days. And finally, the wildlife biologist, when he got bitten, he said, "That's it. We're going to call the big ones the females and the small ones the males and the ones in between every other one." You know? And we were worried, you know. We wanted following instructions. And, shoot, they just took off like a wildfire, from what I understand. It was, the idea was a porcupine control measure.
Yes, fishers do feed on porcupines, among other things. They actually feed on just about anything they can catch and fit in their mouths. But they, those releases that you were part of certainly were a huge, one of the great success stories in restoration of wildlife, because there are certainly fishers all over the place up in that country now.
Yeah, that's a great story. Thanks, Dick, for calling. Appreciate your call.
Any member of the weasel family in a bag is not something to be taken lightly. Not if you want to keep your, not if you want to be referred to as stubby.
I wanted to mention a couple of things I wanted to mention before we take more calls. I wanted to mention the Ice Age Trails open house at its new main office on Main Street in Cross Plains is Saturday, July 18th at 5 p.m. So I want to be sure to mention that. July 18th at 5 p.m. That weekend will include trail construction in South Central Wisconsin. So put that on your calendar. So that's one thing. And I earlier mentioned grape jelly, and we're doing our, you know, we've got two feeders and filling them 1.5 times a day, both feeders. We've got Orioles coming out of our ears.
I would guess that the grape jelly manufacturers should do a survey, because there's more jelly going to the Orioles than into peanut butter sandwiches these days. But we're filling ours daily. And in my case, in the kind of the middle of that prairie restoration, those birds have got to fly a couple hundred yards from the tree line to get to the feeder. But that doesn't deter them at all.
They're
still going at it. So it's one of the great, among our various types of feeders and positions, I'd say in the family, the Oriole feeder is the most popular thing we have out.
We have a mulberry tree as well, which I think helps us considerably. Mm-hmm. But I know at our Wisconsin Public Radio dinner this past weekend at our home, there were some people there who were highly envious, who had...
They were covetous of your Orioles. Yes.
Because they were landing right while we were... everybody was there having their grape jelly. John and Frederick, we'll go to you next. Hi, John.
Good afternoon, guys. I'm the rattlesnakes.
Yeah.
A friend of mine in the cities, in conjunction with DNR of Wisconsin, runs a inventory, so to speak, census count of rattlesnakes here in Wisconsin along St. Croix.
Right.
The Kennecott River, just north of the River Falls, seems to be the northernmost range of the timber. And anything else that comes up further north are probably riding on the hay bale or whatever from down south.
Right.
That's all I have for you guys.
Oh, right. Thank you.
And I think John's exactly right. Sometimes they wind up in a hay bale or something like that.
And well, lots of things end up in hay bales. There's been some interesting pictures on the internet lately of things like about badger twined up in a big round hay bale. And of course, the story that I probably use most from everything we've ever done on public radio about the prairie dog that showed up over in Ferryville on the Mississippi River, that apparently showed up in Wisconsin in a load of hay from the Dakotas. And then lived, I think it was 8 or 9 years in this family's farmyard. That was a great story.
Great story. Dan in Madison, on to you now. Hi, Dan.
Hi. I don't know if you'll be able to answer this question, but maybe you can give me a couple of theories that you might have. My wife and I live in Portage, and we've had an inordinate amount of house wrens this year, and they've had a lot of new hatches. There's one that we've been watching out in front of the house. Mom and Dad have been feeding them for a long time, and they're getting louder and louder. On Sunday, we could stand out there, and Mom and Dad were going in with worms and bugs all day long. Monday, I went out there, and I didn't hear anything, and we weren't being scolded by the parents, so I figured that they had flown the coop. I went in and got a flashlight to look inside, and there was a body plugging the hole. I took the top off the house, and all five baby wrens were dead, and they were 1 or 2 days away from flying. Inside the house and on the outside of the house, there were thousands and thousands of little tiny mites. Would that have had anything to do with their demise, or can you give me a theory? I mean, they were eating the day before, and 24 hours later, they were dead.
Well, I mean, for one thing, you described this all occurring at the end of an incredibly hot spell. I mean, it was really hot last week, and these deaths were noted at the end of that period. So if, in fact, there was a high mite or ectoparasite problem that may have been debilitating the young anyway, and you have the added pressure of the extreme heat, I mean, that may have been enough to do them in. But there are, if you know, the wrens aren't as closely followed as bluebirds as far as a box bird. But in the bluebird box literature, you know, there are lots of concerns and accounts over box management with black flies and a variety of parasites that need to be accommodated for and sometimes treated for if you want to prevent loss of the fledglings. So I'm guessing your observation did have something to do with it, but again, not sure, but certainly though that number of mites in conjunction with the extreme temperatures probably killed the whole brood.
Would it have maybe weakened their lungs and inhaled the mites, perhaps?
I think it may have been if these were mites that may have been essentially blood feeding on the birds, that they were simply debilitated over time.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
All right. Thanks for calling, Dan. And Mike in Menominee Falls, on to you. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I have a question about roosting at night. We have a basswood tree on our property.
Yeah.
And a lot of times I'm finding all small little branches broken down in there. And you can look up in the canopy, and it's all the big branches, and there's some white droppings there. This has been going on and off for years, and I try at night to sometimes late at night just to look up with a big spotlight to see what might be roosting up there, but I've never been able to catch anything.
So your thoughts are you've got this big basswood, something bird probably because of the whitewash and droppings is coming in there and recently night
breaking
off the
twigs. And it just sits on the bigger limbs in there. We got wild turkeys running around every once in a while.
Well, turkeys are a possibility. There are a variety of raptors that will sit in a tree like that, and there may even be enough smaller birds or even something like crows or whatnot. But a lot of those things are so noisy and tend to come into roost just at dusk that you should be seeing them.
That's what I mean.
Yeah, even turkeys will usually go to roost before it's pitch black. And they're so big and noisy. You know, when you're hunting turkeys and flush one in the brush, I mean, they just crash, bang, and whatnot. So, you know, what I'd be tempted to do, if you don't have one, find somebody around who's got a trail camera and put it up in the tree. And you're going to get a picture of whatever's sitting there. I mean, pick a limb that seems to have a lot of whitewash on it, mount the trail camera, and you'll get a picture of whatever's up there.
Yep.
And then you'll know.
Then you'll know. Good luck. Thanks for calling. And we have a picture here from Christine in Wazika's. This is in my garden area. It's about 90 feet from our trout stream. It's a hole, a round hole, about 2 inches in diameter. And she wonders what might have caused that hole.
If it's a low water table and so forth, it almost looks like a crayfish chimney from the picture, especially because this dirt that's out of the hole was obviously wet and muddy as it was pushed up, and it's in little pellets and whatnot. Most mammals aren't very happy about that kind of wet soil, but there are a few things, like I can't tell the diameter, but it looks like it's
maybe
the size of a quarter or 50-cent piece. Star-nosed mole, maybe another possibility that would be near water. But crayfish chimneys, the crayfish will push up a large mound or almost a chimney or kind of like a castle turret around its burrow where it's pushing out these pellets of soil. So star-nosed mole, crayfish, what other possibilities? That's all that comes to mind looking at it this way. Okay.
And with that, Scott, we are out of time. Thank you so much. We didn't get to everything, but we'll do our best next month.
We'll be back in August. The creepy thing is it's only like 8 or 10 weeks now until school starts again and then the fall hunting seasons and assorted other things. So summer's going to go by quickly now.
Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest, and he'll be back the first Wednesday of August. Taking a look at tomorrow, Steve Buzalaki comes by to talk about doctors and end-of-life planning at 11, then 11:45, boating safety with Todd Schaller of the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.